Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Schumann called Chopin a genius. Chopin came by to visit Schumann in Leipzig. They were both born in 1810, both celebrated this year on a 200th birthday. But quite different men and pioneers of romanticism in classical music, says my guest today, New York Times music critic Anthony Tomasini. This hour on Point, Schumann and Chopin at 200. You can join the conversation. Do you know their stories? Who died of tuberculosis in Paris? Who threw himself in the river in despair? How they shaped our musical heritage. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll hear in this hour from great pianist Garrick Olson, who's helping observe the composer's 200th. And, of course, behind us right there, Chopin, loud and clear. Joining me now from New York is Anthony Tomasini. He's chief classical music critic for the New York Times and former music writer for the Boston Globe. Tony Tomasini, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be here.
So it's a great big round birthday. Everybody likes to celebrate those. They're not Lady Gaga or Pink on stage last night.
No, but they've stuck around for a while.
They've held an audience for a long time. Begin to take us into how these two emerged in the time when Beethoven sort of overshadowed everything, and here come these two. Introduce us, for those who may not know them well, Tony Tomasini, Chopin, Schumann.
Well, they were both born in literary households. Schumann was born outside of Warsaw, and as an infant, they moved into the city. His father was French-born, but had come as a teenager to Poland, where he basically taught mostly French literature. Despite that, George Sand, the novelist with whom Chopin had
Chopin born outside of Warsaw. Right?
Yes, did I say Schumann?
Yes.
But George Sand said Chopin was more Polish than Poland, even though he was raised in this kind of French-cultured household. But Chopin's talent was unmistakable from the beginning. He was incredibly precociously, brilliantly talented, so talented, so individualistic at the piano and in his improvisations that he essentially considered himself self-taught. Schumann was born in Zwickau in Saxony, and his father was a lexicographer. He wrote romantic novels. He did translations, made quite a bit of money doing translations of Walter Scott
and Byron.
Mm-hmm. But there, music was just practiced as an amateur endeavor. And Schumann's father died when Schumann was 16, and it was a stipulation of his will that in order to get his inheritance, Schumann had to complete 3 years of university training, and he went very miserably unhappy to law school, which he in Leipzig. But during that time, he studied piano with Frederick Wieck, who was a famous pedagogue and pianist, who was also the father of Clara Schumann, who was 9 years
Wieck,
younger.
That is the child prodigy,
who
he ultimately married, against the wishes of her father,
completely against the wishes of her father, because he wanted. Friedrich wanted Clara. He thought she had the potential to be the greatest pianist in Europe. And despite marrying this dreamy, mentally unstable Schumann, and despite having 8 children with him, she basically became one of the greatest pianists in Europe. I think their married life was difficult, but I think they were devoted to each other, very devoted.
Chopin ending up dying of tuberculosis in Paris. We won't keep a mystery here. Schumann, who ultimately threw himself into the Rhine, pulled out by fishermen, spent his last 2 years in an asylum.
In an asylum, yeah. And he seems to have been troubled by mental instability and all his life. It's poignant and tragic at the same time that this whole fantastical side of Schumann that came out in his music, especially the piano music, this incredible imagination and wild, wildness and inventiveness, where he made up names for his, you know, sub-personalities, and but all of that had another side. I mean, it was also he also had a kind of bipolar, you know, tendency to be depressed or elated, and and he had delusions later in his life. And heard voices. So, but it was sort of the other side, I think, of his incredible, ingenious creativity and imagination.
Let's begin to dip in and compare. Here is Schumann's very first symphony. The composer, in a way, coming to grips with the nine symphonies of Beethoven that towered over this whole period, defined the genre. Here's Schumann's first symphony in B-flat major, third movement, the Scherzo. Anthony Tomasini, it seems like Big Daddy Beethoven standing right in the doorway looking over this thing. You feel him, his presence so imminently.
Well, in an article I wrote about a week ago for the Sunday Times, I tried to get at what was the difference between these two composers. Obviously, they were both early romantics. They were both early pioneers in this movement, and they both wrote a lot of piano music. There are obviously broad similarities, but they were quite different. They were also both obsessed with counterpoint and revered Bach, and tried to combine in their music the kind of fashionable feeling for virtuosity, instrumental virtuosity of the day, with this rigorous counterpoint. But the big difference I settled on was the Beethoven. Beethoven loomed, who died in 1827, loomed over the whole generation as this intimidating figure who sort of made you feel like you had to write these formidable, very structured symphonies and sonatas and concertos. And Schumann took that very seriously and sort of quaked under that influence. And he did turn out four symphonies, of which that one is a great one. But Chopin cared nothing about this. It passed him right by. He couldn't have cared less. He loved Bach and Mozart were his gods. He loved bel canto opera, especially Bellini. But otherwise, he was emblematic of the to be a pianist in Schumann's and Chopin's mind was to be an improviser and a composer. He played mostly his own music. He befriended composers of his day like Berlioz and Mendelssohn, but he was not particularly interested even in the other music of his day, where Schumann was intensely interested in it.
Didn't write Chopin for full orchestras like as Schumann did. Here's one of the few times. It's his first piano concerto, but the piano still featured very heavily. This is the first piano concerto, E minor, first movement, 1830. Improvising was Chopin's way of composing, you write, Tony.
The most trustworthy description of Chopin's composing process has come to us, I think, through George Sand. And she said that
this was the great French novelist and his lover, ultimately.
She was 9 years older, and they were lovers for about almost a decade. And there was an oddly maternal quality to her of devotion to him. But she said he would sit down at the piano and essentially improvise something. Then would come hours and days of agony and turmoil and, you know, tears and anger and fits, and he would change and change and revise and revise, and then finally settled on something which sounded to her very similar to what he had initially improvised.
And out of that, what, that sort of wonderful sort of drifting melodies that come from Chopin, that maybe because of his way of composing, it's far from the heavy architecture of Beethoven.
It's not it's hard to describe. I mean, it's not that the pieces don't hang together or have structure. They do. But there is a kind of improvisatory sort of forward motion to them. It's event after event after event. There's no sense of overall structure, the way there is in a Beethoven symphony, but even in the Schumann symphonies, something he tried to achieve.
Let's hear a little. Let's hear a little more of these back to back. Here's a Schumann finale from the opera Genoveva, 1847. Schumann. And there's opera. Let's go to Chopin. Here's C-sharp minor etude for piano, 1832. Anthony Tomasini, talk about a finger-twisting etude. There it is. No voice out front and all kinds of delightful complication right there.
He was 19, 20 years old when he started writing the etudes. Eventually there were 24. Then he wrote an additional three. And if you can play the Chopin etudes, you can play anything written for the piano before or since the Chopin etudes. And they were unprecedented in the demands that they placed on for independence of the fingers and intricacy. I mean, what makes them so hard? It's not just the flashy bravura virtuosic stuff. It's that embedded in all of that flashy bravura stuff, there are inner voices and inner lines. They're intricately difficult, awkwardly difficult.
We will come back and hear much more from these two greats, Chopin and Schumann, and hear from piano great Garrick Ohlsson. Anthony Tomasini of the New York Times is with us. We're celebrating this year 200 years since the birth of both Frederick Chopin and Robert Schumann. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to take a break from Lady Gaga and go back 200 years? Can you imagine being the first generation to compose in the shadow of Beethoven? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here's Schumann, piano quintet in E-flat major. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at this hour two great classical composers born within months of each other 200 years ago this year, 1810. Chopin and Schumann and the lives and music they made. Anthony Tomasini joins us. He's chief classical music critic for the New York Times. In just a couple of minutes, we'll hear from the great pianist Garrick Ohlsson, who knows what it is to play these. You can join us as well. Are you a fan of the early romantics? Who's your man, Chopin or Schumann? Did you play them? Do you wait for one or the other at the symphony? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And how's it sound after maybe if you were up last night watching a night of Grammy music these days? 800-423-TALK. This behind us right here, Chopin's Waltz in D-flat major, performed by Garrick Ohlsson, who we'll hear from in just a moment. AJ in San Diego, California. AJ, you're on the air.
Good day. Mr. Tomasini, enjoy reading your column in the Times.
Thank you.
As a youngster, two of my favorite recordings were both Rubinstein, the Rubinstein Skrovachevsky Chopin First, which is still available on CD. I think it's now on a mid-price hybrid from RCA, or the remnants of RCA. And the other was the first stereo recording Rubinstein made of the Schumann A minor with Josef Krips. He did another one in that was in 58-60s. He did one with Giulini in the Chicago, which is also a beautiful performance to my ears. And then years later in Canada, in Ottawa, at the National Arts Center, I was privileged to hear Angela Hewitt perform the Schumann A minor with the Swiss conductor Matthias Bemer in the NAC Orchestra, and they did a fantastic job. It's a shame they never recorded it together. In 1994, thereabouts, Stanislav Skrovachevsky did the Bruckner Fourth in San Diego, and after the concert, I asked for his autograph and mentioned how one of my cherished recordings was the one he did at the Chopin with Rubinstein, and he smiled and he said, "Ah, yes, Arthur and I had so much fun making that record."
And why not? AJ, you know your stuff. Tony, do you follow it with the same fine-tooth comb? Who's got the finger on the pulse of these two? And do interpretations, you know, have they changed radically over time or depending whose hands they're in today?
I think they I wouldn't say there's a trend of change, in my opinion, but I think there's always been a spectrum, especially with Chopin, of the approach to rubato and rhythmic freedom, which I have never been much of a fan of if you push that too far. Mm-hmm. And one reason I love Rubinstein, and there are many beautiful, wonderful pianists who have played Chopin and do today, but I think if you want a sort of gold standard, Rubinstein is it, and it's partly because there's something so tasteful and honest and direct, and there, of course there's flexibility and the music breathes and there is rubato, but it's never overdone. There's clarity in the texture, but there are remarkable Chopin pianists and Chopin performers. Dino Lipadi's early recording of the Barcarolle is one of the great piano recordings ever made, and also the Chopin Third Sonata. Both Chopin works are just, I cherish them both, but they're some magnificent, beautiful. I love Christian Zimmermann's recent recording of the two concertos with an orchestra that he put together for a special tour, where he really worked and worked and worked on the orchestrations, trying to convince audiences that actually these orchestrations are not so bad, that there's stuff in them that they can be made to work. But and the guest we're going to hear from soon, I think, is also tremendous, wonderful, very tasteful, very intelligent, very terrific Chopin player, Garrick Olson.
Right now, no less, Garrick Olson joins us from New York. First won the Frederic Chopin International Piano Competition in 1970, has appeared as a soloist with every major orchestra in the United States, won a Grammy in 08 for Beethoven sonatas, and will be performing this week at Alice Tully Hall for the 200th. Garrick Olson, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Hello, it's a great pleasure.
Give us a sense of sitting down to perform Chopin first, and where does your mind go when you prepare to do him justice?
Oh my, I don't think we have enough time for that. it's such a big subject. I would like to say that, first of all, following what you've been saying, yes, Chopin does have this improvisational quality. He doesn't deal with the Beethoven architectural model. He rather like Mozart, it sounds more like the music is being invented on the spot, even though within the case of both Mozart and Chopin, there's a tremendous amount of premeditation and total structure underneath.
Mm-hmm.
When I sit down to play Chopin, it depends which piece and where. I never know how it's going to come out. Now, take this in the context. I am not a very capricious person emotionally or player, but I know where I'm going and what I mm-hmm. want. Mm-hmm. But for example, when I play the first note of the concert, which is an F-sharp octave of the impromptu Opus 36, I know more or less where I'm going, but just the timbre, the way it comes out on the piano in that hall on that night will tell me whether, and instinctively, nothing intellectual, I'll just hear that sound and know whether I want to wait a millisecond before I play the next note, which is an extraordinary pair of notes, like all things in Chopin, or whether I just suddenly it was a little deader than I wanted and I need to move it a bit. In other words, Chopin, with Chopin, I know the music so well, it's so much inside of me that I just, I let its flow, its content speak to me at the moment, but yet you have to be totally organized in your head and know exactly where you're going in the large sense.
You're famously a kind of a strapping 6'4 Paul Bunyan guy. Chopin famously the sort of 98-pound weakling, tubercular and all the rest. Does that matter in the sort of delicacy of his compositions?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, one comment I used to enjoy sharing very much, we always laughed about it with the late Alicia de la Rocha, was she was always being told, I can't believe that such a tiny lady plays so powerfully. And they're always telling me, I can't believe such a big guy plays so delicately. Well, you are supposed to be responsible for all ends of the spectrum, of course. And I love to play soft. Chopin and I don't have much in common. As I say, he never weighed more than 100 pounds. He was ill most of his life, and he died at 39, and he hated playing concerts, and I'm none of those things.
Let's hear, variations on Mozart's La Ci de Rheims, La Ci de Rheims from Don Giovanni. When Chopin played a rare performance of this piece, he complained, he didn't like to play for big audiences, that the audience clapped so loudly that I had difficulty hearing the orchestra. Chopin. Anthony Tomasini of the New York Times is with us, and great pianist Garrick Olson. Have you played this one, Mr. Olson, sir?
Oh, well since I have played, yes, since I've recorded all of Chopin, I have played this
one. Okay.
But I've also played it in concert a number of times. It's a beast.
It sounds like it.
You know, that, can I ask
please, Tony,
Olson a question?
Yeah.
That raises a question we were trying to get at before. What is the difficulty of Chopin? Alfred Brendel, who played quite a bit of Liszt, almost never played Chopin, and he was asked about it once in an interview, and he said, oh, Chopin does the pianist in. And audiences might think that Liszt, just by listening, is the harder composer, but I've always found that Liszt fits the hand so much better. Chopin is so, there's such intricacy and difficulty to it. What do you feel about
I agree with everything you say. I don't agree with my distinguished colleague.
Yes.
With Liszt, you get maximum effect for minimum effort a lot of the time.
Yes.
In other words, you get some incredible roar or noise, and the audience thinks, oh, my God, how did you do it? It might be something as simple as a glissando, which is just noisy. Whereas with Chopin never, ever stoops to effects. Not that Liszt stooped to them. I love Liszt, too. But Chopin's, as you say, it's more twisted. It's more intricate. It twists and turns the hands. You know, when his etudes were published in Paris, you know, some reviewers said nobody should attempt these without a hand surgeon present. In fact, the secret is, for me, and it has to do with your individual hand, but that once you master these intricacies, which you have to do with the suppleness that Chopin always demanded, they become rather organic. They never become easy, though. They're highly calibrated, delicate athletics. It's a bit like a triple Lutz or something. If the ice skater is supposed to do a triple Lutz at this point and only does a double, well, it just doesn't count, does it? You're kind of on point a lot with Chopin, whereas with Liszt, you're showing off your biceps.
Right. I mean, I love Liszt too, but I wager that most pianists would find it much easier to play the two Liszt concertos than the two Chopin concertos.
Absolutely. Well, I can't speak for most pianists, but I would say there's no contest.
Yeah.
Let's get a call if we may from Jan. Lots of folks listening to the two of you and one in. Hi, Annis, Massachusetts. Jan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My dad is Polish and a veteran of the Second World War, and as is probably common with people of that generation and from that part of the world, my brothers and sisters and I were raised listening to classical music, essentially until the point where we could afford radios in our early teens. So I was very familiar with Chopin and, of course, the history of Poland, particularly in the Second World War. And there's a timeless quality to Chopin, sort of a regal melancholy that bespeaks the tragedy of the country and just reminds me of the Warsaw Uprising and the ultimate end of the nation and also the indomitable spirit of the Poles. And the description of Chopin being more Polish than Poland is very apt.
Jan, let us pick it up, and I'm so glad you called. Of course, the November Uprising in back in the 19th century led to Chopin leaving, become one of many Polish emigres, the great emigration there.
Actually, it happened the other way. He had just left to seek his fortunes elsewhere, his musical fortunes, and he made it to Vienna with a friend, and then the uprising happened, and the friend went back. But Chopin kept on and eventually wound up in Paris, but he never made it back to Poland. He never got back.
Do you feel, Tony Tomasini, first to you, in these two men, Schumann, Chopin, do you feel nationality in their compositions, or is that too, you know, boundary-oriented?
I mean, Chopin's father was French. He spent so much of his life in France. There's something almost that anticipates Debussy in his music. There is that kind of quality. But yes, I do feel the Polishness of his music, of his thinking, and I think he did too. All the dance pieces, and there's something even about the folkloric character of some of the melodic writing, and there is a kind of quality of an outsider too, I think. I mean, I don't know what Garrick feels about that, but I do, although it's very hard to describe.
Garrick?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Chopin was an outsider. He was the first nationalist composer. No composer had come out of a smaller, not that Poland is so small, but compared to France, Germany, and England, yes. He was the first So in other words, he was the ambassador from his country to the rest of the world. He was the first of the greatest composers to come from anywhere except the center of Europe. And yes, he was a fully formed artist by the and person and composer by the time he left Poland. He had written masterpieces already. I mean, Slum Movement of the F Minor Concerto. He was fully formed, and he was deeply, deeply enrooted in the Polish countryside where he spent vacations. You know, when Chopin had the piano brought on the terrace in a summer vacation, and the peasants danced mazurkas, and he played for them. This wasn't just a country guy who was trying to do an article about the countryside for the Warsaw Gazette or something. He actually he felt very identified, and he felt much more deeply Polish than French. Although of course he was half French, but he even he even poked fun at some French who just mangled Polish names and words so badly. And in fact, his French, I gather, while excellent, was not of the stature of a native language as his Polish was.
It was not flawless, and there was a large Polish émigré community in Paris, so he did not have flawless French. And his writing of French was not flawless.
Let's think about the other side of this equation, Schumann, Chopin, for a second. Here's the guy who towered over their time, of course, just a couple notes of Beethoven. Good Lord, what a shadow, Anthony Tomasini, for anyone in that time to be laboring under. Schumann, less escaped from it, ultimately, than Chopin.
Schumann did not escape as much, I think, but I think one reason I particularly adore the piano music of Schumann is because I think there he maybe escaped it the most and found his own way, like in a work like Kreisleriana, to make it organic, or the fantasy, despite its title, is one of the most beautifully structured Schumann pieces, but it's very unconventionally structured. And he was able to be more fanciful, more imaginative, more impetuous, I think. And it's when he wrote his chamber works and the symphonies that he felt like, well, and the string quartets, I have to behave here. I have to come up with something.
Let's listen, if we may, to a little bit of that piano toccata. This is Toccata in C, Schumann for piano, 1832. Schumann's Toccata in C for piano. Gary Colson, what's the gear shift when you move from Chopin to Schumann at the keyboard?
At the keyboard, Chopin is, as I said, is this organic composer of highest athletic difficulty. Now, the finger twister like the Schumann Toccata stands in the shadow of nobody in terms of finger twisting difficulty also.
Yes.
The gear shift is, I feel, more emotional than pianistic. I mean, Chopin's music is born of the soul and of the piano, and you don't know which came first. The instrument was in transition. I think Schumann, a little bit more like Beethoven, wrote what he wanted to hear, although now it would be very difficult for me to define my terms. I think he wrote what he wanted to hear. I think that it's more of an emotional shift. I think Chopin is the Apollonian master of his demons, and I think Schumann is the Dionysian victim of his demons, as it were. Chopin was almost remorseless. He was a demonic, very passionate emotional artist, but he kept everything not under wraps, not by any means, but everything was perfectly formed. Whereas with Schumann, gets carried away. Well, Schumann wrote so much more music, and Schumann was also a great improviser, don't forget.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that when music was written down, it had already lost something. And he was frighteningly productive in his short life. And he didn't polish every facet of the things to the degree that Chopin did, although he did sometimes. But I think it's the unhinged quality of Schumann that I think I saw mentioned in Mr. Tomasini's article that one pianist talked about that gets me. In other words, Schumann starts to infect your cell structure in a certain way, and if you're uncomfortable ever, or if you're ecstatic or thrilled with it, it's all incredible. It's a very internalized state.
Gary Colson, it's so terrific to have you with us. Can we keep you a few minutes longer?
You may.
Oh, how wonderful. And Anthony Tomasini, please stand by. We're talking about Chopin and Schumann as they hit their shared 200th birthday this year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at two great classical composers this hour, born within months of each other 200 years ago this year, 1810, Chopin and Schumann, and the lives and music they made, with Anthony Tomasini, chief classical music critic for the New York Times, joining us today from New York. And also from New York, we are honored to have with us the great pianist Garrick Olson, who will be performing at the Alice Tully Hall this week, a diverse program of Chopin's work in honor of the big 200th. You can join the conversation in this hour. Are you a fan of the early Romantics? Who's your man? Chopin? Schumann? And did you play them? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Behind us right there, Schumann's Kreisleriana, number 7, 1838. Calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky, is Liza. Hi, Liza, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your thought?
I just wanted to comment. I've been listening to your program and how you and your guests have addressed the genres of solo piano works and symphonic works and even concertos for both Chopin and Schumann.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to make a comment on the genre of Lieder that was composed by Schumann, specifically even the Frauenlieben und Leben that he composed, and his complete genius in combining text and music, and his ability to broadcast both this sort of dichotomy between the mental state of what the text is expressing as well as the physical state of either the character that the text is addressing or even the poet itself. And it's just genius. It's amazing to hear his Lieder performed as well as perform them. So,
Liza, have you performed it yourself, the German songs, the Lieder? Have you performed them?
Yes, sir, I have. I actually just gave an anniversary Schumann concert of the Frauenlieben und Leben and a collection of songs by his wife, Clara Wieck. So,
how terrific.
It's an amazing experience, yes.
Stick with us, Liza. Tony, what do you say to Liza? That's sort of the way that it all pulls together there in the Lieder.
Well, Schumann once said when he was young that he thought he was about equally talented as a poet and a composer. And I'm not sure that was true, but that was his own feeling. And mm-hmm. his deep love of literature and poetry sort of found this wonderful, blissful symbiosis when he started writing songs, which he really started doing in 1840, the year he married Clara. There was just this outpouring of songs, and it was actually liberated him. I think Lisa's right that his feeling for the text is so acute and so sensitive and so psychologically astute. But it also, I think, because of I think that whole Beethoven thing he didn't have to think about because he had the words to guide him, and just making the words come off the leap off the stage at you and off the page at you, you know, was and come alive in your musical imagination was what he needed to do, and boy did he do it.
Liza, give us a favorite line, if you would, from what you've just sung. You don't have to sing it.
Well, there's a line, I believe it's in the sixth song that's sung, where the wife is telling the husband that she's pregnant, and there's just this combination of the underlining harmonies that are taken care of by the piano, the dynamics that are asked for by the singer, as well as the text where she's saying, you lovely, lovely man, I'm going to give birth to your child and our child. And it's just the way that he sets that. It's only two measures, but it's to me, it's the most, you know, amazing part of the cycle. I mean, both the piano and the singer are pianissimo, and it's just this very quiet, intimate moment between husband and wife, and it's amazing.
Well, that's great. That's just how my wife told me. Liza, thank you so much. One more, David in Waterbury, Vermont. David, you're on the air.
I'm a clarinetist, and I've enjoyed playing over the years Schumann's fairy tales and fantasy pieces and romances. And I know that much of this literature was written at a time when Schumann was going in and out of psychiatric institutions. Mm. And when I play these pieces, I often try to get inside the head of Schumann, which is very hard to do given what he was going through. And I'm wondering if either one of you can tell me how you think his struggles with mental illness was expressed in his music.
It's a great question, Garrick Olson. I don't know if you actively look at the biography to inform performance. But...
Well, I do. I never know whether there's much direct correlation, but certainly in the case of Schumann, as I said, I invented this phrase earlier that he was a Dionysiac who was suffered from his own demons as well as rejoiced in them. Mm-hmm. I think that it's for the performer. I can speak for the pieces that your listener mentioned that, and many others that but I think it's present in all of his music. There is an inward, compulsive, hyper emotional, hyper subjective feel of playing Schumann always. And I think he sort of inhabits you, and sometimes it can be pretty dark. But to put a one-to-one correlation into words would be very difficult. It's not my field. But I would also come back to what Liza was talking about, who defined, I think, very beautifully in very few words and very eloquently what is the miracle of Schumann and his Lieder and, indeed, of all great art. But she was able to encapsulate it with a single thing. So in any case, back to our clarinetist friend, I would say that how does it inform it? Well, there in a lot of the late works, I feel there's almost an opaque quality in Schumann. It takes all, they're tough nuts to crack. You really have to, get inside the notes and the symbolic world of the notes and really lay yourself open to it. And sometimes that's occasionally a very uncomfortable process. But
meaning, are you doing psychoanalysis in performance?
Intuitive. Intuitive psychoanalysis, but in other words, all I can tell you is that the feel of these pieces, for example, the three Fantasiestücke, very beautiful, is so. How can I say? You know, especially in the sadder ones, the music infects you deeply. I guess. Anyway, enough said. I'm not really good at this, but I would say that Schumann has an incredible inward power this way, and I don't really know how it is. On a case-by-case basis, his mental illness informed the composer. I don't know. I also just want to point out at this point that, you know, it's never to be underestimated that the two of them were in such different universes, Chopin and Schumann. Chopin had his kingdom of the piano and the human heart. He was absolute there. But look at the range of Schumann. I mean, he was a polymath, and he was one of the all-time, all-round musical geniuses. So, I mean, anyway, so I guess I both vote for both of them, don't I?
Let's hear a little Schumann Carnival, 1834. Tony Tomasini.
Yes.
Yes, he had a difficult interior life. Dionysian suffering. But how about this one?
This piece almost expresses, I think, the point that Garrick was getting at, that Papillon, butterflies, okay, it's a whirlwind, but it's not the kind of whirlwind that Mendelssohn would write. You know, that would have been very playable and effervescent. This is sort of knotty and gnarly, and it's got these inner voices that you have to kind of bring out, and it's a little crazy. It's a little extreme, you know, for a piece called Papillon. And playing it, you think, well, do I really try to make it just sound like carefree butterflies, or do I really wrestle with all these kind of ornery little things that are mixed up in the middle of the textures? It's a little... it's a little out there. Maybe that's the way to put it. But, I mean, I adore it, and I love that piece, and I've played it.
And after whatever you play, you've said, Garrick Olson, if you play a program with no Chopin, and then you play an encore and say the name Chopin, they say that the audience say ah and
the
applaud.
It just goes ah, and it's as if they're sort of saying, well, that's really what we wanted all along. Yeah. It's true. Chopin has the quality of being utterly beloved. He's one of the most beloved classical composers, and even those who know very little classics, if you play some of the famous Chopin tunes, they sort of swoon too. Back to Schumann and Papillon for just a second, since I can't resist.
Yes.
I think this is, as Tony said, this incredibly convoluted, gnarly, and yet manically exuberant kind of music, which I think Chopin didn't like in Schumann very much.
Right.
This kind of unrestrained expression of the inner self, I mean, with no formality left, in order to get in there, you got to get right in there. But I'm now projecting on both of them terribly. But, I think this kind of music made Chopin very uncomfortable.
There's no particular record that Chopin had this great affection for Schumann's music. You know, I think he respected him like he did other composers, but he just wasn't particularly interested.
Well, we'll go out with Chopin in this 200th year anniversary of the birth of each. Schumann was good enough to call Chopin a genius. Hats off, gentlemen, a genius, he wrote, I think. Chopin's Piano Concerto in F Minor. This is the third movement. Garrick Olson, performing Chopin in New York at Alice Tully Hall this week. It's been such a delight to have you. We're very honored. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And Anthony Tomasini, chief classical music critic for the New York Times. Wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for bringing all this music in and your keen observations to us. Tony Tomasini, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In a moment, a look at the 2010 Grammy Awards. Last night, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The music industry held its big annual Big Dance in Los Angeles last night. The 2010 Grammy Awards ceremony saw some of the industry's megastars take home the hardware. The biggest winner, with 6 awards, pop R&B singer Beyoncé.
This has been such an amazing night for me, and I'd love to thank the Grammys. I'm sorry, I'm nervous. I'd love to thank my family for all of their support, including my husband. I love you.
Yeah, she loves him, and what a big show she put on. Joining me now is James Reed, pop music critic for the Boston Globe. He was up late live blogging the whole awards ceremony last night. James, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So that was some show. There was Beyoncé, receiving her award, but let's listen to a little bit of her with her big show number, If I Were a Boy. James Reed, wow, if you want spectacle, we've been talking Chopin and Schumann, but if you want spectacle, it looked like a scene in that hall from Star Wars or something last night.
I think Beyoncé is probably just as operatic as some of the stuff we just heard in the classical music. I mean, I said in my live blog entry last night, it's almost like Beyoncé didn't even need a microphone to be performing that song. But, you know, this was the year for her. This is really the first album that she's made in my mind that is really even worth a Grammy. You know, for those who don't know, I Am Sasha Fierce was essentially a concept record. Sasha Fierce is sort of an alter ego that Beyoncé created to sort of say and do whatever she wants. And, you know, it's not a masterpiece, but you cannot deny sort of the commercial and just sheer sensation of some of these songs. Of course, Single Ladies put a ring on it. It was an anthem last year, you know, from sing-alongs to YouTube homages and Halo, which was also a big winner last night.
James, it's really something what the Grammys, I mean, they've always been in a way, but increasingly have become. The Oscars, you've got actors talking in some film clips, but this is really a spectacle. It's a great big show.
It was a big show. I mean, you probably noticed there were a lot of sort of unusual pairings. Some made sense, like Roberta Flack with Maxwell, and others you just thought, what on earth is, Mos Def doing with Placido Domingo? But it was a great spectacle. I mean, I think that actually it started on a high note, obviously, with Lady Gaga and Elton John But I thought in general that there was a little bit of energy missing from the performances.
What's that about? Because it's all industry, it's sort of self-congratulation. How do you interpret that?
What was interesting about the nominees this year is that the Academy really recognized the three sort of commercial powerhouses from last year, and they all happen to be young female artists. You had Lady Gaga and Taylor Swift and Beyoncé, but you didn't really have any drama. You know, there weren't a whole lot of surprises. I mean, Taylor Swift acted like she was surprised every time she accepted an award, but really this is a young woman who's been on a roll for the past several months. I mean, her film must be crap, but she's getting tons of accolades, and there weren't a whole lot of surprises in my mind.
Here's the Zac Brown Band, Atlanta-based country group, won Best New Artist last night. So here they are on stage singing Chicken Fried.
Things we love, like our chicken fried.
Some song, James, they're thanking American soldiers for being out there, you know, defending the country so we can enjoy all the things we love.
Yep.
Chicken, fried chicken and jeans that fit just right. Not exactly the Bill of Rights.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think for a lot of folks, you know, the Zac Brown Band was maybe a bit of a revelation. If you don't listen to commercial country radio, you might not have even heard of these guys, but you know, the fact of the matter is, of the five nominees for Best New Artist, Zac Brown Band is the platinum-selling artist in this category. They had the biggest record, and you know, oddly enough, they actually had their first album in 2004, and so they've actually been around a little bit longer. But you know, you can't deny whenever you've got a big hit on the radio and everyone knows it, you know, your chances of winning might be a little bit better.
Oh, it was a terrific, terrific sound. And to see Leon Russell with him, with his great white beard and white hair, looked like he'd been rolled out of some, I don't know, distant galaxy. Pretty great.
My understanding is that Leon's a little bit of a hermit, so it's kind of funny to see him back there, you know, looking like he could, the grandfather of ZZ Top.
Fun that they could bring him out. Lady Gaga's making waves with her very effective sort of, colonization of all things digital. But how's the music industry doing in general? It's celebrating itself last night, but how's it making out these days, James?
Well, again, you see this reflected in the nominees. You know, these were the people who brought home the bacon, essentially, for the industry last year. I mean, Taylor Swift had the second highest selling record of last year after Susan Boyle. You know, I Am Sasha Fierce, another big seller, and of course Lady Gaga actually released her album in 2008, but last year was her year, and so I think, in a way, this is almost a statement of almost rewarding the people who bring, you know, really bring the money.
And Michael Jackson there in 3D, no less, posthumously.
Yeah. I thought that was incredibly poignant. I was a little skeptical when you get this sort of hodgepodge of performers. I thought the song was quite good. You know, if this had been released tomorrow, I could totally see this being a hit. I thought the people who performed, from Celine Dion to Usher, I thought they were incredibly into the song, and just there was a real reverence for Michael Jackson that we've seen since his death in June. To me, it was one of the most affecting moments of the show last night.
Earth Song from Michael Jackson, posthumously last night. James Reed, pop music critic for the Boston Globe, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for the report on the Grammys.
Thanks so much, Tom.
We'll go out here with Taylor Swift performing Today Was a Fairy Tale, Grammy stuff. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.